Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, which also sponsors PBS's CEO Exchange, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We got the economic double team from the White House today. Treasury Secretary Paulson said the government's doing all it can to solve the housing crisis. Later on, the president himself weighed in. You want the headlines, do you?
This is a resilient economy.
And from American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Monday, the 7th of January, 2008. Great to have you with us. The president went to Chicago today to talk about the economy. He met Friday, you might remember, with Treasury Secretary Paulson and Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, for what was billed as an economic summit. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Ganzer covered the president's speech today for us. Hello, Nancy.
Hello, Kai.
Nancy, the president has this thing he does when he talks about the economy. He says the foundations are solid. Was that pretty much the story again today?
It was. And he used almost those exact words. Foundations are solid. He acknowledged that we do have some problems. Some people had wanted to hear some more details from him, both about the state of the economy and any economic stimulus proposals that he might have. But he was very short on details.
Let me ask you sort of a subjective question here. Do you think it's possible for the president now to come out and be completely frank and say, listen, I know the economy is in some trouble. Just bear with me and we'll see what happens?
You know, Kai, I actually put that question to a couple of people today. One person said, look, there's no way the president can be honest. If the president were totally honest, the markets would tank and everybody would panic. Now, I also put that question to Robert Shapiro. He was an undersecretary of commerce in the Clinton administration. And he said, boy, the markets would love a touch of reality. They know what the reality is. And if the president says it, they would be cheered, in his words, and they would feel like the president was really going to do something about it. But he said President Bush was, in his words, dissembling when he talked about his record on job creation.
Either the president is sadly misinformed by his economic advisors, or he's making statements that aren't supported by the data.
Let's talk about some of that data, though, because he did do a little bit, the president did this morning, of the economist's old trick of on the one hand, on the other hand. He said, you know, consumer spending is good, but inflation's a problem with food and gas. So clearly, the White House economic staff is aware of the situation here.
That's true, although Shapiro, for one, had wanted more specifics on, for example, the unemployment rate. He says if we counted the millions of people who are unemployed who've given up looking for work, that the jobless rate would be much higher than the 5%. That was reported on Friday.
Nancy, before I let you go, what about Congress? The president did refer to Congress several times this morning, mostly in reference to his tax plan. But what about an economic stimulus package coming out of there?
They're not saying a lot either at this point, although Senator Charles Schumer of New York was asked about this. He hinted that maybe he'll look to give lower and middle income consumers some more money to spend with some tax cuts for them. The chair of the House Financial Services Committee, Congressman Barney Frank of Massachusetts, Democrat of Massachusetts, he says that his committee is also weighing some new programs to help state and local governments reduce their inventories of unsold real estate. So there are lots of proposals being floated around Washington, but nobody is giving any specifics yet.
More to come, I'm sure. Nancy Marshall-Ganzer in Washington. Thank you, Nancy.
You're welcome.
To give the Treasury Secretary his due here, Henry Paulson did touch briefly on the credit squeeze in his remarks today. He said he hasn't been terribly surprised by the write-downs Wall Street banks have been taking. He also said the economy is probably going to get worse before it gets better. Lots of companies are already feeling that pinch of a slowing economy. Orders and revenues are down. Problem is, many of those companies took out big loans before the credit squeeze hit, and now they're having trouble making their payments. But the banks are playing tough. Our New York Bureau Chief Joe Barshay explains.
Herbst Gaming is one of the largest operators of slot machines in Nevada. But after the state passed a smoking ban, its business went south. Herbst was in danger of defaulting on its $875 million loan. Steve Miller is managing director of Standard & Poor's LCD. He says the lenders restructured the loan, but it cost Herbst a whole percentage point.
It's no different than a credit card company saying that, okay, we're going to lend you some money, and then suddenly you start to make some late payments, you're not getting back to them the way you should, and then they charge you late fees, they hike up your spread. It's the same exercise.
Miller says many high-risk companies with big debts are in the same position. Greg Steckel is one of the lenders jacking up rates. He runs a portfolio of loans at Invesco, a big institutional investor.
We are asking for more at this point. Corporate earnings look like they're softening. So we've reacted by saying we just demand more of a risk premium to put money to work.
That might mean a lot less money is put to work, according to Steve Miller of S&P.
It makes it more difficult for people to borrow money, clearly. It makes it more expensive for people to borrow money. And the terms under which you're borrowing have become much more rigid than they were in the past.
Miller says one reason American companies grew so fast is because they had cheap and easy access to money. But lenders are a lot more tight-fisted these days, and Miller says that could be another drag on economic growth. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay from Marketplace.
Two more quick nods to corporate America today before we move on. There is a certain tradition that goes along with corporate profit reports. For some reason, Alcoa is always the first big company to report its earnings. That'll happen on Wednesday, thus giving us the first real look at how things went in the heart of the credit squeeze. And I don't know if you saw the item this morning about McDonald's. It's going straight after Starbucks, adding cappuccinos and lattes to its drinks menu. Didn't take Starbucks long to react to that. Late this afternoon, the Seattle coffee maker announced former CEO Howard Schultz is coming back to the top job. Schultz isn't the founder, but he is the guy who built the company that got us all paying $4 for a cup of coffee. Americans are once again heading to the internet in droves for their holiday shopping needs. This time, though, they are selling, not buying, as in auctioning those gifts off on sites like eBay rather than returning them to stores. Experts say today could be the biggest day of the year for online regifting. From Washington, Jeremy Hobson has more.
It's the first post-holiday Monday, and people are back to work with their speedy internet connections. In Wake Forest, North Carolina, Brian Sanders is trying to sell a black sweater. His parents gave it to him for Christmas, but he already has one.
I didn't have a receipt or anything, and I didn't have the heart to, you know, tell my parents that they had gotten me something I didn't need, so I just decided to resell it.
He says it retails for around $20. He's selling it on Craigslist for $12. It's the low end of a growing market that stretches from sweaters to flat-screen TVs. Marcia Collier wrote the book eBay for Dummies.
A lot of times you really don't know what store the item came from. So what you do is sell it for whatever you can get for it, because certainly whatever money you get is more than you have when you have a gift that you don't want.
Collier says increasingly people can't be bothered to go back to the store and stand in the returns line or try to use gift cards they don't want. So they simply resell.
It is a secondary market, no doubt about it.
That's Boston College marketing professor Kathleen Siders. She says when people pawn off gift cards that never would have been used, retailers feel the pain.
So many people never redeem their gift cards. It's an enormous bonus for retailers. But if people are selling them online to people who will be redeeming them, then that really puts the retailers at a loss.
But the retailer's loss can be the consumer's gain, especially when you can get a $200 gift card for $120. I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
That mini boom we had in commodities last week seems to have run its course. Oil dropped more than $2 today. Gold eased off its record highs as well. And Wall Street didn't get any of the reassurances it was looking for from the president today. Of course, he didn't really rain on the parade either. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Try though you might, it's going to be tough to avoid hearing something about the Consumer Electronics Show this week. And not just because the exhibition sprawls over almost 2 million square feet of prime Las Vegas convention space either. There are also thousands of reporters there to tell us about the newest gadgets we didn't really know we needed. There's a special emphasis this year on cars and all the fun electronics being built for the road. In fact, the head of General Motors, Rick Wagoner, is going to make a keynote speech on the high-tech car of the future. But Marketplace's Bob Moon found out plenty of electronic gadgets on wheels are already here.
The final frontier for the car-making universe could turn out to be consumer electronics gadgetry. If you haven't noticed, some of us are now barking out commands to our onboard computer, much like Captain Kirk and his successors.
Computer, request security procedure.
Computer, status report.
Computer, activate emergency medical holographic program.
Well, forget talking to the computer. With Ford Motor Company's popular new system called Sync, developed with Microsoft, you address your iPod or other music players.
User device?
USB. Please say a command.
Play track, Big Jazz.
Playing track, Big Jazz.
Automakers and the consumer electronics industry are making sweet music together.
It's time to fasten your seatbelts, because I think what we're seeing is a revolution as these two amazingly important industries begin to collide and merge.
David Cole heads the Center for Automotive Research in Detroit. He says music interfaces and GPS navigation units are just the start.
Things that a few years ago we would have said was essentially impossible in a surprisingly short time are going to probably be routine and fairly inexpensive.
New gadgets will give you real-time traffic information along with your directions. They'll point you to the cheapest gas, and they'll read your email to you. Detroit has been exploring this kind of high-tech gadgetry for many years. It's taken General Motors nearly a decade to make inroads with its navigation and emergency help system.
Connecting to OnStar.
These days, GM is offering its pioneering system on a much wider variety of models, not just luxury cars. Chrysler just introduced a navigation and entertainment system. It's dubbed MyGig. David Cole says it makes sense to cater to a broad base of customers who've grown up staying connected. He says it's no accident that Ford is offering the Sync system on its Focus model.
A car more likely to be purchased by a younger person. So they are recognizing this generational difference that is key. The ability to customize and fit every person's needs is very important.
Cole says Detroit automakers might even have an edge for the moment on their Japanese rivals.
I think they're back in the game big time. Of course, there's nothing like impending hanging to create a sense of urgency, and that's what we have seen in the last few years in Detroit.
The gizmos that are attracting all this attention are relatively cheap. David Thomas is an automotive reviewer at Cars.com. He doesn't think the automakers will make much money selling these systems. Mainly, he says, they're hoping the hot new electronic add-ons will lure you into the showroom. If that sounds more like the way iPods are sold, Thomas says maybe that's what Detroit needs, a more rapid turnover rate by car buyers.
You know, if car makers could get them doing that every 3 years on a purchase, they'd be very happy. The average is every 5 years right about now.
And if Thomas is any indicator of the 30-something market, Detroit just might be on the right track. He got to drive a Sync-equipped car for 2 weeks before he had to give it back.
I missed it. I was kind of bummed. I wanted that to be in every car, you know, besides the awe of it knowing every single artist, weird artist name, which I couldn't believe. Afterwards, you were like, boy, I really missed that system.
Thomas says some dealerships have told him customers are asking for the new high-tech systems without knowing exactly which car they want. Detroit definitely seems to be on to something. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
You can get a fancy gadget to tell you where the heavy traffic is, but it can't get rid of the traffic jam itself. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg has a plan to do that. He wants to charge drivers a fee to tool around Manhattan's Central Business District at peak hours. Later this month, something called the New York State Traffic Congestion Mitigation Commission will begin discussing the mayor's proposal. Commentator Tyler Cowen says congestion pricing on the roads could solve some other problems, too.
Traffic and the housing market are two of America's biggest messes. But we could improve both problems at the same time. As it stands, it's estimated that American traffic jams waste $78 billion a year in time and fuel. The best way to cut down on traffic is to make people pay for the right to drive at rush hour. If people have to pay a price, they'll cut out their non-essential trips or shift them into other time slots. So far as mechanics go, toll booths are a waste of time. So let's enforce a sticker system or bill people with electronic sensors, as they do in Singapore. London now uses rush hour pricing, and initially skeptical Londoners have largely been won over to the idea. Singapore, the pioneer in charging for road use, is one of the few major cities in Asia without regular gridlock. Road pricing sounds unfair to a lot of people because they think that only the rich can afford to pay the tolls. The current reality is that many people have 2-hour commutes each way, And that's even more unfair. Let's not forget that lots of people would rather have more time than more money, and pricing the rush hour commute would give them that. More time to look for bargains, more time to spend with their families, and more time to enjoy the pace of life. Cutting down on traffic also would help our troubled real estate market. It would be easier to buy a home further away from town, again because commutes would be shorter. This would help many home prices and give us more residential choice. And if you're worried about global warming or the government's budget deficit, road pricing will help these problems too. If you make something free, there's not going to be enough of it. Don't think the roads are any different. When it comes to rush hour pricing, let's just do it.
Tyler Cowen is a professor of economics at George Mason University. His latest book is called Discover Your Inner Economist. If you do, discover your inner economist, that is, tell us about it. Our website is marketplace.org. Coming up, college athletes are hoping for a little something extra in their scholarships this year.
You know, I like to see the money go up a little bit more. That way, we're not putting together a couple bucks just to go get a burger or something like that.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rose 0.2% today, 27 points to close at 12,827. The NASDAQ fell 0.2%, 5 points, closed at 2499. The S&P 500 moved up a third, about 4 points to end the day at 1460. And a lot of moving around before that closing bell, though. Sony scored today. The video game maker saw its stock shoot up more than 3% after announcing more than 1.2 million units of PlayStation 3 were sold in North America over the holidays. Shares of Biogen jumped 7.25% on news that the biotech company will post stronger than expected annual profits. Looks like the Crocs fad might be blissfully over. Shares in the specialty shoemaker cobbled off 14% today on news the company has quietly cut its workforce. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Siemens. From grade school to grad school, Siemens supports America's next generation of innovators with Student Science Days, plus scholarships and awards for students, schools, and teachers. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, President Bush meets with the President of Turkey before departing on a trip to the Middle East. The Federal Reserve Board reports on consumer credit for November. And all eyes turn to New Hampshire for the first primaries of 2008. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. As the presidential campaign has developed over the past couple of months, most of the emphasis has moved from national security to domestic policy, things like health care and the economy, what are traditionally called core middle-class issues. Candidates from both parties are trying to hit that sweet spot. Jim Kessler helped found a think tank called Third Way, and I asked him exactly how we ought to think about what the middle class is.
One of the things you need to realize is that the middle class is wealthier than most Democrats believe, and the middle class is more optimistic and aspirational. So, for example, the median household income in America is $46,000, but if you eliminate households headed by 21-year-olds and 91-year-olds, and you look at working-age families, the median income is $62,000. If they're married, it's $72,000, and that's the difference between struggling to get by, which Democrats usually talk about, and struggling to get ahead, which is the reality of the middle class. And a lot of times, Democrats are just misconnecting there.
How do you think this year's crop of candidates are doing?
I think if you look at Barack Obama, he really is playing to the optimistic, aspirational middle class. And if you look at, say, John Edwards, it's really the old Democratic way of looking at the middle class, which has never really proven to be that successful, and that is that the middle class is extremely insecure and really on the precipice of poverty.
And we know how that turned out in Iowa the end of last week. Let's put you on the spot here and talk about New Hampshire tomorrow night.
Well, I mean, New Hampshire is probably a state that's more suited to Barack Obama's message of aspiration than Iowa. You know, New Hampshire is a wealthier state, and it's more of a white-collar state, less of a manufacturing and a farm base. So I think it's tailor-made for somebody like him, just like it was tailor-made in 1984 for Gary Hart, who also had a very kind of future-oriented, optimistic middle-class message.
What about the Republicans? How have they been doing in terms of attracting the votes of the middle class?
Well, the first thing you have to remember is that Republicans in almost every election win the middle class. So if you look at elections between 1990 and 2006, congressional elections, Republicans have won every single election except for 2006, going back to 1990. The very simple message of lower taxes and less government has worked for Republicans, I think in part because if you look what Democrats offer, what their signature Democratic programs are for the middle class, they actually don't really benefit the middle class. They benefit people hoping to get into the middle class. Pell grants for college, Head Start for low-income kids, raising the minimum wage. You know, really, people who are in the middle class, for the most part, do not benefit from these programs. And if you're told, hey, this is our middle class program for you, a lot of middle class think like, well, you're talking about somebody else. You're not really talking about me. So Republicans start generally most races with an advantage among this group of voters.
If you take a snapshot, though, of today's economy, this one right now, with the jobs market from Friday being really shaky and corporate profits being a little bit questionable, I mean, how does that impact people's perceptions of candidates in regard to the middle class and what they can possibly get done for them?
Well, I think that in a bad economy, it will encourage Democratic candidates to be more negative. And, you know, to a certain extent, sure, people want to hear that you understand that the economy is not doing well. But on the other hand, people don't want to just have a litany of their anxieties and fears. They want to have a path to success and progress and prosperity. So I think the candidate who can say this is our way out is the one that's going to do the best, not necessarily the candidate that says this is how bad your situation is.
Jim Kessler is with the think tank Third Way in Washington, D.C. Mr. Kessler, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Owning a home is one of the hallmarks of the middle class, and sales usually ramp up after the holidays. We want to know if you're planning on buying or selling or refinancing this year. Tell us through our website. It's marketplace.org. Curtain comes down on the college football season tonight in New Orleans. Ohio State plays Louisiana State in the All-State BCS National Championship game. As the name implies, you're going to see plenty of All-State ads and sponsorship mentions along with your football. You're also going to get NCAA-approved ads for Pontiac and Enterprise Rent-A-Car. One thing you're not going to see, though, is current college players plugging those products. From Oregon Public Broadcasting, Ethan Lindsay explains why and why that might change soon.
Greg Laybourne saved a touchdown.
The National Collegiate Athletic Association, or NCAA, has strict bylaws banning a school from profiting off a student athlete's name or image. That's why you'll never see a current college athlete pitching, say, Gatorade. But those rules would change under a proposal currently being discussed by the NCAA. Bob DeCarolis is the athletic director of Oregon State University in Corvallis, Oregon. DeCarolis says right now he'd vote no on the plan to allow sponsors to use an athlete's image.
It just borders on some things that will open up some other doors that you might not want to go in at this point in time.
Skepticism like his postponed a planned January vote on the issue, but the College Board says it will push forward for an eventual decision. The NCAA already makes tens of billions of dollars in TV contracts and commercial sponsorships. But student athletes are considered amateurs and so are banned from receiving any salary or gifts related to their play. Critics say the new rule change is just another piece of that big money commercialism seeping into amateur athletics.
Yeah, it's just one more step. And, you know, the NCAA should be kind of the lead on the thing, and they're actually kind of trying to backdoor the system here a little bit.
DeCarolis says he thinks the NCAA is already breaking its own rules. That's why it's pushing so hard for this rule change. Take this in-game ad.
You, the fans, have spoken. Your votes have deemed these plays as the four best Pontiac game-changing performances of the year.
Under a marketing deal, the NCAA gets millions of dollars from Pontiac. In exchange, Pontiac awards a game-changing performance play every week using the video and images of the week's best collegiate football plays. Mark Roundtree is the Associate Athletic Director of Compliance for Oregon State.
I'm that person who ensures that the institution is following those rules regarding recruiting, regarding amateurism, regarding financial aid.
Roundtree actually works for DeCarolis, but he says he thinks the proposal is a good idea. Recently, Roundtree sat down with a group of athletes to discuss the possible rule change. He says some of the athletes actually like the idea of having their name up on a billboard or on a box of cereal.
Not all student athletes are football players and basketball players, so they don't have the opportunities to go on and play professional sports. So for those student athletes, it's a little different.
Still, the students voted against the rule change because they wanted to have veto power over the products and services they were associated with. For instance, a vegetarian soccer player may not want to be on a poster advertising McDonald's. Kyle Devan is not that guy. He's a 300-pound senior offensive lineman for the Oregon State Beavers football team. But he says there's a discrepancy between schools getting more and more cash from sponsors, all while he and his teammates continue to scratch by on little more than scholarship allowance money.
You know, I think at times it feels like we should be paid more than we are. You know, I like to see the money go up a little bit more. That way, we're not putting together a couple bucks just to go get a burger or something like that.
Everyone involved promises that the rule change will not put more money in student-athletes' pockets. And players like Devan say that may be the problem. In Corvallis, Oregon, I'm Ethan Lindsay for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, Yale University got a nice financial boost last year. Its endowment grew 28% to $22.5 billion. School officials announced today they'll be spending more on financial aid for students and for scientific research as well, about 37% more in all. You might remember late last year, Harvard announced an overhaul of its financial aid program. Yale's got a similar plan. It's not going to give us any details, though, until a formal announcement later this month. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. The major indices were up, down, and all around today. The Dow climbed 27 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ fell 5 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 was up 4 points. That's about a third of 1% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, fancy cars, corporate jets, expensive cognac, just staples for China's elite.
China booming, and we want to know where all these rich people are hiding.
I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll tell you about that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.